Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who discusses Saudi Arabia's intervention in the current conflict in Yemen, which, along with a blockade, has exacerbated the nation's humanitarian crisis. Sophia Cope of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who assesses the current effort to repeal or reform Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act that permits government warrantless surveillance of Americans' phone records. And Jen Siskind of the group Food and Water Watch, who explains why she opposes six New England governors' plan to invest billions of dollars in natural gas infrastructure that will tie the region to fossil fuels for decades to come. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the tragic deaths of 900 migrants from war-torn Libya that occurred last week in the Mediterranean Sea, the European Union was compelled to reconsider its hardline approach against immigrants. In an emergency summit, EU leaders voted to triple the budget for sea rescue and intensified efforts to break up migrant smugglers' networks. Only months earlier, EU leaders declined to fund Italy's widely praised Mare Nostrum rescue operation off the coast of Libya, which saved the lives of 100,000 migrants. Instead, the EU Border Control Agency set up Operation Triton, prioritizing border security over humanitarian relief. But the border protection strategy failed to stem the tide of desperate migrants, and the death toll at sea skyrocketed. After the recent deaths of 900 migrants, humanitarian groups and the United Nations complained about the EU's minimalist response to the crisis. For now, EU leaders, including Germany's Angela Merkel and Britain's David Cameron, have changed their policy, contributing ships to aid and rescue operations. A statement by Save the Children declared, "Europe took a small step away from the moral abyss, but it needs to do much more to provide clarity and turn this momentum into lives saved at sea." In December, progressive activist shareholders won a major victory when military contractor Northrop Grumman canceled its membership in the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a key force promoting voter suppression laws, gun rights, the privatization of public education, and other far-right policies. To date, over 100 corporations have pulled out of ALEC in response to shareholder and public pressure. According to the news magazine In These Times, conservatives are complaining about the influence and effectiveness of liberal shareholder activists. 2 years ago, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce issued a report claiming labor-backed shareholder groups were damaging the financial interest of millions of retirees. At the same time, activists on the left say many shareholder activists are too willing to seek compromise positions, dropping their advocacy for more far-reaching change. According to the nonprofit Sustainable Investment Institute, progressive shareholder activism has grown steadily. There were a record 454 socially and environmentally focused resolutions filed in 2014, about 50 more than in 2013. More than half of the resolutions filed last year targeted investment groups and pension funds. In 2014, nearly 40% of the resolutions addressed climate change, sustainable governance, renewable energy, and other environmental issues, while 30% had to do with corporate political activity. Laura Berry, director of the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, noted, "The power we have is the reputational risk. Companies don't like these issues being brought to the attention of all the institutional shareholders." Months before Hillary Clinton launched her 2016 presidential campaign with a listening tour in Iowa, Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus sent a team of opposition researchers to Little Rock, Arkansas, to dig up dirt on the former First Lady and Secretary of State. The current effort is an echo of the 20-year-old Arkansas Project, funded by right-wing billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife, which turned Whitewater and Troopergate into public scandals in a failed attempt to politically destroy the Clinton White House. But observers of the 1990s investigations think there isn't much left to expose since the Clintons left Little Rock in 1992. The new target is the family's international nonprofit Clinton Foundation. The current attack is contained in a new book, Clinton Cash, by conservative author Peter Schweizer, who charges that Hillary was influenced by donations to the Clinton Foundation to use her position as Secretary of State to provide public policy favors to those donors. Peter Schweizer has worked as a foreign policy advisor to Sarah Palin, was a fellow at the Koch brothers-funded Hoover Institution, was a former speechwriting consultant for George W. Bush, and has a history of botched hyperpartisan reporting. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The war in Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's president, Abdul Rabu Mansur Hadi, began last September after rebels seized control of the capital of Sana'a. The World Health Organization says that the death toll from the conflict has now exceeded 1,000. Saudi Arabia and Gulf allied nations launched airstrikes targeting the Houthis on March 26th. But Jamal Ben Omar, the former United Nations envoy who mediated talks between Yemen's warring factions, says that the Saudi air campaign derailed a power-sharing agreement that was close to being finalized. The Houthis, who belong to an offshoot of Shia Islam, known as Zaydism, have received military support from forces allied with now-exiled President Hadi's predecessor, Ali Abdullah Saleh, Yemen's former ousted president, who had waged his own war against the group beginning in 2004. Although the roots of Yemen's conflict stem mainly from internal strife between competing factions, the U.S. media has largely portrayed the fighting as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia supporting President Hadi and Iran, which backs the Houthi rebels. Your reporter spoke with Chris Tensing, executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of their publication, Middle East Report. Here he discusses what led to Saudi Arabia's intervention in the conflict, which, along with a blockade, has exacerbated the nation's humanitarian crisis.
The first thing to know is that this conflict is very much internal to Yemen. It's very much a homegrown conflict. The proxy war aspect of it is real, but quite minor compared to the internal real civil war dynamic that is really driving the fighting. And it's an outgrowth of conflicts that go back at least a decade, if not more, within Yemen. The second thing is that if we are to talk about external intervention as a driver of this conflict, then it's not Iran at whom we should be pointing the finger, but at Saudi Arabia, for two reasons. First of all, the origins of the Houthi movement, they are now called the Houthi rebels, and the forces that are described as Iran-backed in the U.S. media, the origins of those rebels is actually a form of Saudi intervention in the 90s and the 2000s, in which Saudi-sponsored Salafi Islamist activists started to go into northern Yemen and start religious schools that competed with the religious schools of the Zaydi majority in that part of Yemen. The Zaydis are a Shiite sect, a heterodox Shiite sect, in the sense that they're different from the Shiites who are the majority in Iran and in Lebanon and in other places. And they're really closer theologically in many ways to Sunnis than to Twelver Shiites in Iran and elsewhere. But basically, the Zaydi clerical elite resented these Saudi-sponsored Islamist schools, and they started their own, and that is the origin of conflict in that part of Yemen, in the northern highlands bordering Saudi Arabia. Later, there was a conflict between some of those Zaydi clerics and their followers and the now deposed government of President Saleh in Yemen, who was Saudi-backed at the time. And there was a series of six wars between the Yemeni government and what became the Houthi rebellion from 2004 to 2010. The other piece of crucial context that is often left out of reporting is that there was, of course, a popular uprising in Yemen that corresponded with the uprisings elsewhere in the Arab world, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, elsewhere. That uprising was nationwide. It was directed, as the uprisings elsewhere in the Arab world were, at authoritarianism and at the lack of life opportunities for the vast majority of the Yemeni people. And part of what we're seeing now is the long aftermath of that uprising. Saleh refused to resign for a long time. He finally did as part of a deal that was brokered again by Saudi Arabia, which basically let Saleh off scot-free for his rampant corruption and all of his crimes while dictator of the country for 30-plus years. And so part of what we're seeing now is the culmination of the deep popular discontent, not just among the Houthi rebels, but among many other sectors of Yemeni society, about the failure of the post-uprising tradition to produce either democracy or greater social justice and prosperity for the majority of Yemenis.
Chris, summarize for our audience the reasons why Saudi Arabia and other allied Gulf states have intervened against the Houthi rebels with a month-long campaign of airstrikes, and also the extent of Iranian involvement in the conflict.
Saudi Arabia has always treated Yemen as basically its playground, its backyard. They have always arrogated themselves the right to play kingmaker in Yemen. Yemen is a very, very poor country. It's the poorest of the countries in the Arab world. And Saudi Arabia, of course, is the richest. So there's a great disparity in power there. The Saudis have succeeded in convincing most of the global media, if not, I don't think, the White House, that what is happening in Yemen is part of some region-wide Sunni-Shiite struggle for primacy. And they have succeeded in convincing everyone that Iran is somehow behind the rebellion of the Houthis and behind the military successes that the Houthis enjoyed in the last 6 months. But there's very little evidence to actually support that. In fact, the Iranians tried to dissuade the Houthis from marching on the Yemeni capital last fall. There is precious little evidence that the Iranians have armed the Houthis in any way. Most of the weapons that the Houthis have been using are readily available on the Yemeni black market and would be readily available from the armories of the former President Saleh and the army units that are under his control.
What is the threat of regional escalation growing out of the current conflict in Yemen? And what, if any, role could the U.S. assume to help end the fighting?
I think so far it looks like this conflict is going to remain contained. Despite what the Saudis say, there is no remotely credible threat that the Saudi territory or the territory of another one of the Gulf Arab states will be invaded from Yemen by the Houthis. That's simply not going to happen. As far as what the U.S. can do, the U.S. has, from the get-go, fully backed this Saudi-led bombardment of Yemen. If the U.S. wants to play a positive role, the first thing it should do immediately, like right now, it should push at the U.N. Security Council a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire, at the very least to allow a humanitarian corridor to be created so that Yemenis who are seeking to leave the country can leave, and so that aid, food, fuel, water, other things that Yemenis desperately need can get into the country. That is what the U.S. should do right now.
That was Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report. Find more news and commentary on the war in Yemen by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Several of the most controversial provisions of the post-9/11 USA Patriot Act that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden revealed to the world in 2013 are set to expire this year on June 1st. Foremost among them is Section 215, which the Bush administration and the National Security Agency has interpreted as permitting the U.S. government to engage in the bulk collection of Americans' phone call records. Section 215 has also been the target of civil liberties advocates, who charge that warrantless surveillance of innocent citizens' communications metadata is unconstitutional, while the NSA and other U.S. intelligence agencies have claimed that dragnet surveillance of U.S. communications has prevented terrorist attacks in the U.S. and around the world. Reform activists say there is little or no evidence to back up that assertion. Now, with just weeks to go before the Patriot Act Section 215 is set to expire, supporters of reform are pushing for passage of the USA Freedom Act that its sponsors say would rein in the dragnet collection of data by the NSA and other government agencies, increase transparency of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and create an independent constitutional advocate to argue cases before the FISA court. But NSA whistleblowers support another bill, the Surveillance State Repeal Act, that would completely repeal the 2001 Patriot Act that the government cites to permit dragnet phone and internet surveillance. Your reporter spoke with Sophia Cope, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who who talks about why the civil liberties community believes it's necessary to repeal and replace Section 215, as well as the strengths and weaknesses of the proposed USA Freedom Act reform bill.
The government has been very clear in explaining that the 215 phone records collection program only encompasses the collection of what is called metadata. So it's not the actual collection of the contents of telephone calls. It's basically the to and the from and sort of the timestamp, like when the call was made and for how long. And so the government has claimed that this information really doesn't have any kind of privacy interest. And we vehemently disagree with that. If you collect so-called metadata about someone, you don't know what they're talking about, but you can see who they're calling and for how long and when they're calling. And if you collect that information over a long enough period of time, you can get a really, really good sense about what that person does on a daily basis, right? And who is in that person's network and what their interests might be, right? And so we argue that metadata has just as many privacy interests as the actual content of communications. So we and others have challenged this collection. Under the statute itself, we don't think that Section 215 on its face authorizes bulk collection. We think that it is and was intended to allow for collection in only very specific instances related to discrete and particularized investigations, where there's a sort of a specific suspicion of someone and not just sort of dragnet surveillance. And then, yes, we have brought constitutional challenges in a couple of different cases, primarily the main challenges under the Fourth Amendment. So that states that Americans have the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and if the government is going to collect records about them, the government needs to have a warrant from a judge that is supported by probable cause that those records would reveal criminal activity.
Sophia, I wondered if you would talk about proposals for reform, including the USA Freedom Act, which, as I understand it, has stalled in Congress, but with this June 1st expiration date of portions of the Patriot Act coming up, there's a push on to garner support among legislators.
Right. So the USA Freedom Act, as it's been called, was introduced last Congress. We reluctantly, but we ended up supporting it mid last year. You know, we thought it could go farther, but ultimately we did support it. We are expecting it to be introduced this Congress. We actually thought it was going to be introduced last week. And then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he strongly opposes the USA Freedom Act, and he introduced what we call clean reauthorization for Section 215. So without any kind of amendments or, you know, changes to the program or additional oversight to the call records program, he just wanted a clean extension of 215 to 2020. The ultimate goal of the USA Freedom Act is to end bulk collection of U.S. citizens or Americans' phone records. And the way it would do that is that it would require the use of what's called a specific selection term. So that could be a phone number or a device ID. But basically, a specific selection term has to be associated with an individual or a device. And that can be used to get a court order that then would be issued to a service provider, and that service provider would basically do like a keyword search, basically, using that specific selection term and return any hits back to the government.
Sophia, are you optimistic that down the road the Congress will adopt the USA Freedom Act with these reforms to the bulk collection of Americans' phone data?
I would say that we're cautiously optimistic, which I think a lot of advocates say that. In the House, there was a lot of support for passing USA Freedom. The Senate is always sort of the stickier chamber. A lot of the Republican leadership, like Mitch McConnell, for example, are vehemently opposed to reforming Section 215 surveillance. But there are other Republicans like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Mike Lee who think it's appropriate to enact surveillance reform. So, yeah, I would say we're cautiously optimistic. Now, what's important for your listeners to keep in mind is that right now, Section 215 is what folks are talking about. But there are other bulk collection programs going on related to internet content, for example, under different provisions of law. And we really don't have any public information as to the efficacy of those programs. But we and others have challenged the legality of those programs as well.
That was Sophia Cope, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more information on the campaign to repeal and reform Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Five New England state governors met behind closed doors in Hartford, Connecticut on April 23rd to discuss regional cooperation on energy, specifically when it comes to increasing the availability of fracked natural gas. The governors say investments in the billions of dollars are needed in natural gas pipelines and transmission wires in order to reduce New England's electricity prices, which outside of Hawaii are the highest in the U.S. Top energy officials from all six New England states shared their views on energy issues before the governor's meeting at a forum open to the public but with no audience participation. They promoted an energy policy that primarily focused on fracked gas, along with a minor role for renewables, energy efficiency, and nuclear power. After the presentations, dozens of opponents of fracking, representing 43 organizations in all six New England states, protested state government's focus and investment in natural gas. They advocate money instead be spent on clean, renewable energy technologies such as solar and wind power. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who covered the governor's meeting in protest, spoke with Jen Siskind, a staffer with the Connecticut chapter of the group Food and Water Watch. Here she warns that fracked gas infrastructure will keep the region tied to fossil fuels for decades to come, while exacerbating climate change.
We are currently being assaulted with fracked gas pipelines, toxic compressor stations, and a build-out of infrastructure which is going to keep us tied to fossil fuels for decades to come. And what we need to do instead is move to renewable energy. And we need strong leadership from Governor Malloy and from the rest of the New England governors to get there. We have the technology right now to be able to do this. Well, we can use shared solar. We can use photovoltaic arrays. We can use onshore and offshore wind. We can use local microgrids that distribute energy in towns that can help finance and fund and support these systems. And we need to move to these brand new systems rather than stay tied to the status quo that we've used for decades that we know is affecting climate change.
There was a united front, as far as I could tell, from all the states on the importance of all of the above, which seems to primarily include more natural gas, fracked gas. So, and everybody says, yes, we want more renewables, we're moving to more renewables, more energy efficiency, but it's not, we can't get there fast enough, and if we don't go to gas, people won't have power.
I think that's a very carefully crafted public relations statement. I think it feeds right into the gas companies that are looking to make profit. We can move to renewable. We can use efficiency as well so that we do not need to build out this massive infrastructure. And there's a reason that the governors are holding a closed-door planning session. There's no transparency with this. They're talking about we need all this gas to reduce our energy costs, but they are planning to push the cost of these multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects on the public, on us. They're planning to put these costs, multi-billion dollars, on our utility bills. So we, the public, will be paying for private infrastructure that's owned by private companies that will be profiting from moving all this gas into New England. So Connecticut needs strong leadership. New England needs strong leadership. It's already happening in other places, and New England governors need to step up as well. Fracked gas is not clean energy, and it's not climate friendly. My mother has gas wells all around her property in Pennsylvania, so I know firsthand how polluting this source is. I know how toxic it is to the air that they breathe. I know how toxic it is to groundwater and surface water sources. And the more gas that we bring into New England means the more chemically toxic, radioactive fracking waste we're going to produce. And every well is producing tens of thousands of gallons of this toxic waste. Last year, Governor Malloy was not willing to support a ban on bringing waste into Connecticut. So instead, we have a short-term moratorium, and now Commissioner Klee is talking about regulating fracking waste in Connecticut. And we've already had great leadership shown on a local level. The town of Washington, Connecticut, has banned fracking waste and are trying to protect themselves from these future hazardous regulations that are going to be considered for Connecticut.
And when you said the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection is considering regulating fracking waste, that's a bad thing from your perspective. That means they would allow it but regulate it somehow as opposed to ban it.
Yes, and there is no way to safely regulate this waste. Commissioner Klee can write all the rules in the world that he wants. However, he cannot control whether spills or accidents will occur with tanker trucks bringing this waste into our state, across our highways, across several counties of Connecticut to have it disposed. He cannot control whether manifests are accurately reported, and he most likely will not be able to test every single sample that comes into Connecticut to assure that radioactive levels are low enough to not be hazardous.
The governors and their representatives here at this very untransparent gathering this morning, you know, we're all on the same page about the need to expand gas coming into the whole region. And they're saying that it's the bottleneck, it's why prices are so high and why there's a possibility of not having enough and rolling blackouts. And are opponents of increasing fracked gas use in New England talking about working together also?
We currently have an alliance between activists in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. So all six New England states, people are working together trying to push our leadership in the correct direction, because right now they're taking a wrong turn path.
That was Jen Siskind of the Connecticut chapter of Food and Water Watch. For more information on groups opposing natural gas fracking and promoting alternative energy sources, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.